I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Trumpism in context. It has a past and doubtless a future. In Italy, 20 years ago, it was called Berlusconismo. The earmarks in common are uncanny and obvious, as Silvio Berlusconi himself has noted. Billionaire populism, a political takeover by showbiz rules, the implicit idea at the core that a national government could become one big folder in a businessman's portfolio. Almost nothing in the uneasiness about Donald Trump becoming president, especially around conflicts of interest, didn't come to pass in the tumultuous downhill run of Italian politics from the mid-90s. So we are getting the short course this hour on just how Italy jumped the gun in the mid-90s, discovering the charms and the risks in a peculiar swerve in the style and form of democracy. Here are a few of the TV headlines you might have heard in high Berlusconi time.
Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has appeared in court in Milan for a corruption trial.
One of those women, it's claimed, was Karima Al-Marrouj, better known by her stage name, Ruby the Heart Stealer.
Berlusconi, charges of incompetence and mismanagement.
Berlusconi and others pocketed around 250 million euros when they inflated prices.
Now, some are calling Mr. Berlusconi's words racist. Others say he was simply joking.
This is the first conviction he can't appeal. But he remained defiant.
And I would say this looking straight into the eyes of my judges. I am innocent. Innocente!
Our conversations begin with Silvia Poggioli. To public radio ears, the most trusted voice, this side of the Pope anyway, on everything that happens in Rome. We asked Silvia, just for fun, to begin with her famous sign-off.
This is Silvia Poggioli in Rome. Berlusconi, just like Trump, started as a real estate developer, and then, thanks to a lot of political patronage, he created a near monopoly of commercial TV. This is a country that had been used for decades to just state-run TV. Very boring, serious, but boring. Berlusconi's three private networks brought into Italian homes a glitzy carousel of soap operas, quiz shows, and scantily dressed showgirls. He had a lot of popular following. Then in the mid-90s, when there was this big bribery scandals and the whole political establishment fell apart, Berlusconi feared that the left would come to power in the next election and endanger his business holdings. So he plunged into the political fray, as he put it, using a soccer expression, I'm going to enter the playing field. Anyways, in just a few months, he created a political party, and he presented himself as this successful self-made billionaire, and he sold many Italians a rosy dream of prosperity and lower taxes, and against all predictions, he swept to power. He even won votes in industrial strongholds in the north from longtime communist voters. It was stunning for everybody.
What was he running against? Is there any truth that he was running to avoid prosecution, get into the government before it got him?
Well, it was mainly to protect his business interests. That was really it. He was afraid, because the previous establishment had helped pass this law that gave him a monopoly on commercial TV, he was afraid the left would change that and he would lose his businesses or they would be very weakened. But the fact was that he stunned everybody. Nobody expected it. And I think what happened is that the media, the pundits, the so-called elites, just didn't understand that he had basically, in a decade, created a loyal audience. He had turned his viewers into voters. He had a ready-made electorate.
Maybe the richest, certainly the most famous businessman in Italy. I mean, it's as if Bill Gates ran for president overnight. But what was it people liked and who liked him? Who didn't? North, South, Catholics, you know, mafia chieftains or university people, business guys. What was the following?
Well, his following, as I said, were a lot of these people who had been totally enthralled by his TV networks. And that crossed left to right in many ways. Certainly the elites, the university educated, no, they were not for him and they didn't get it because they had not been watching his networks. They were too lowbrow for them. That's why it was missed by the commentariat or the punditocracy, whatever. He spoke directly to, you know, the heart of Italians, and he painted this really, really rosy picture that he was going to make life wonderful for everybody. And there was a sort of overlap between the world they saw on TV and the world he promised, and a lot of people fell for it. I think it's important important to say that he was in power for a long time, but never did his own party get more than 37%. It was the biggest vote getter, but he didn't have a landslide.
What's the difference, if any, between your elite establishment in Italian power and ours?
I'd say there was perhaps a little more arrogant, the Italian elite, media elite, a more ideological, perhaps, more divided on left-right grounds, but not that different from the American one today. I wouldn't say it was that different.
What was the establishment knock on Berlusconi? How did it define itself?
Well, he was vulgar, and he was not a professional politician. There was the idea that somebody who comes from business has no experience and therefore has no place in being a politician. It had never happened before.
How did he deal with you, Sylvia, and you with him?
I never dealt with him, actually. He didn't meet the press very much. You know, that was another thing. He was very smart. He hardly ever had interviews unless they were by reporters who worked for him. He had a different way of dealing with the media. It was very much like the way Trump deals directly with the people with Twitter. Twitter didn't exist then. So what he would do is he would record video statements and have them broadcast on his TV. Or else he would often simply call in when a political talk show was on TV, when it was live, and he would call in and speak and talk directly to the audience.
Can you describe him in action? I'm just trying to visualize him as a campaigner. We know the Trump persona on stage, hands up, red tie, blue jacket. What was the Berlusconi look? Was he seductive? Was he charming?
Very charming. But he, since he's a man of television, he also knew how to stage manage everything very well. I do not remember Berlusconi ever doing an outdoor rally.
Interesting.
It was always indoors. In other words, where he could also control who came in. There were never hecklers because they never could get in. It was extremely controlled. And then the other thing he did is that when he created this political party, it all was done in 3 months. He didn't have candidates. His own employees from his various holdings became candidates to parliament. He appointed his tax lawyer finance minister. It was all very much, again, stage managed, even in government.
Who held him to account, Sylvia, either in the press or in politics?
Well, I have to say the great majority of the print media was pretty strongly, I would say, anti-Berlusconi in degrees. Definitely the judiciary, which is independent in Italy. There were lots of investigations. He was brought to court many times. His lawyers, who were then MPs, were very good at passing certain laws that shortened the statute of limitations. So through delays, many of his investigations against him had to be dropped because of the statute of limitations. They even tried to pass a law that would give the prime minister immunity from prosecution, but that law was struck down by the constitutional court. And in the end, finally, Berlusconi was brought down, expelled from parliament after his conviction on corruption charges. That happened in 2014.
Speak about the man. He's beginning to look like a type and a predictive example of a new kind of character. His mansions, his sexual adventures, a kind of narcissism, all sort of badges of, what is it? What is this personality?
Well, you know, he, again, like Trump, self-made billionaires who succeeded in presenting themselves as anti-establishment populists, outsiders. Outsiders, actually, though, who had always had very close connections with the political establishment. Berlusconi was a master of the common touch. He spoke to Italians' gut, not to the head. His promise to lower property taxes resonated in a country of homeowners. His raunchy remarks did not bother a lot of middle-aged women in his TV audience. They were swayed by his constant talk about how attached he was to his mother. And he was really a master of presenting himself as a victim. Even though he had a media empire, he insisted the media was out to get him. His boasts of his sexual prowess and the sex scandals, and especially the demeaning image of women that dominated his TV networks, you know, tainted Berlusconi and Italy's image abroad, but they never damaged him with his core supporters. And his base fervently believed his claim when he was brought to court that he was the victim of left-leaning magistrates and an envious opposition.
What's going on in this man's inner life, do you think?
I think, essentially, he got into politics to protect his businesses. That was the number one thing. He did not have a broader agenda. He didn't have a vision of where he would lead Italy. He couldn't have cared less. It was just basically to save his
really?
Businesses. Yes.
He, too, had an affinity for Vladimir Putin, also for Bibi Netanyahu. He went along with George W. Bush's war in Iraq. There was this kind of strongman cult that he seemed to be part of. What does that mean?
Oh, yes, he's very good friends with Putin. There are perhaps also, beyond just close ties, there also may be business interests between Vladimir Putin and Berlusconi. But there's also business interests, although Italian journalists have never been able yet to find out exactly what the business relationship is. But Berlusconi goes very often to Russia to visit his friend.
And it's not known what they're dealing with?
Nobody knows exactly what business dealings there are.
What brought him down? What pricked the bubble?
The economic crisis, lack of investors' confidence, the huge European debt crisis. Italy was in terrible shape, and there was a lot of pressure from Italy's allies, from Germany and France, from Sarkozy in France and Angela Merkel in Germany, and the man who was the Italian president at the time, Giorgio Napolitano, a very distinguished person who worked very hard to convince Berlusconi to step down.
What's the effect, Sylvia? In Rome, you have to think long term. What's the Berlusconi effect?
I think under Berlusconi, Italy lost two decades of economic development and technological transformation. Essentially, under Berlusconi, for two decades, the country stood still while the rest of the world did not. For all his glitz and his TV savvy, he was not a modern man. He didn't look to the future. He was in it only for himself and for his businesses, and he had no political agenda. At least I could say the damage Berlusconi did was to Italy. The country's not a world player, and at least he did not have access to any nuclear codes. But the country has lost a lot of time. You know, he basically reinforced defects that already existed in the Italian society, the lack of a meritocracy and widespread corruption. Essentially, he made it much worse.
That was Silvio Poggioli of National Public Radio in Rome. Coming up, in 2020 hindsight on 20 years of Berlusconismo, one heroic humanist in opposition is widely recognized now, and she's not a politician and not a journalist either. This is Open Source. Italian politics in the last 20 years can be seen as a prequel of the emerging Trump era in the United States. It turns out there are many good books on the Berlusconi story. My favorite so far is titled The Sack of Rome by the meticulous journalist Alexander Stilla. American-born, of Italian descent, Mr. Stilla wrote the New Yorker magazine's dazzling serial on the modern mafia, which became his book Excellent Cadavers. Even 10 years ago, when his Berlusconi book came out, Alexander Stilla saw a warning about where American politics was heading. As a reporter, he had had the advantage of confronting Prime Minister Berlusconi face-to-face at his home in Rome, feeling the full force of the man's seductive sales pitch and pushing back.
That was one of the most astonishing moments. It was the end of a long interview, and in a way it was a kind of dialogue between the deaf and dumb, because I kept badgering him about the problem of conflict of interest, which, like Trump, he simply didn't see as a problem at all. And so finally he said at the end of it, "Turn off your tape recorder. I want to tell you something." And he said, "You know, I've created an empire. I've made a fortune. I've had all the women in the world. Now I want to give back. I want to create something for my country. I know how to lead. I know how to create. I know how to make people love me." And I thought, wow, we're in a whole nother world. The other thing about it, which is, I think, very significant and very much similar to the Trump phenomenon, is I think Berlusconi was really the sort of first postmodern politician, and Trump is following in that tradition. Berlusconi, like Trump, constantly said things that were demonstrably not true, and yet he said them with such conviction, he really appeared to believe them as he was saying them, that it was very difficult not to be swept up by it, even if you were a well-informed person. So he would say to you, "You know, look, the world is not round, it's flat. I've covered every inch of it. In fact, I own most of it." And you start to think, well, maybe these astronomers have gotten their calculations wrong, because this Berlusconi character seems so convinced of what he's saying. And Trump has that same weird capacity. Both of them are incredibly, or sort of narcissistic personalities. but to a remarkable degree, they're very high functioning. And that's becomes a very, very powerful combination when somebody believes that the world revolves around them and then makes the world actually revolve around them. That's what really is kind of scary.
Stick with that simple matter of recognizing facts. I've heard people in Italy say, you know, Naples has its famous garbage problem, you know, up to their necks in uncollected garbage. He said, well, I solved that problem, but the garbage was still there.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that is interesting and the thing that Berlusconi tested is the question of whether reality still matters in a world that is so heavily dominated by media and by imagery. There was this kind of moment of truth, but it occurred several years into his political career where there had been this enormous earthquake in Aquila in the Abruzzi, and the entire city had been leveled and devastated. And Berlusconi put a lot of prestige into rebuilding Aquila, and we kept hearing about the incredible things that were happening. And more than a year went by, and the people of the city were getting more and more impatient. No one had been allowed into the center of Aquila. And at a certain point, the people of the city who had been moved to sort of encampments on a hillside outside of the town finally went, and they broke through the barriers into the town, and they realized the entire city was still completely in ruins. Nothing had changed in the year in which it supposedly was being rebuilt. And that was a kind of moment of truth in which rhetoric was broken through and one realized that there was nothing to Berlusconi's promises. As a real estate developer, Berlusconi thought, well, let's just build a new town over on this other place. And there were all these contracts and there was a lot of corruption involved of who got these contracts to build all this new housing in a site outside of the old city. What people wanted was to have their city rebuilt. And so they were sort of forced to move to these places where they didn't want to live, and the promised reconstruction of the city didn't happen.
Didn't he say in the Aquila earthquake case, didn't he tell people, in effect, just think of it as a camping trip?
It was a real tragedy. But what Berlusconi did and which Trump does is that he created a kind of media event almost every day. It wasn't through tweeting, but it was through the same kind of making sort of unusual or outrageous statements, provocative statements, things that would shake people up, changing his position on important issues, saying something quite extreme and then taking it back the following day, keeping the press constantly guessing, but remaining at the top of the news every day, this idea of political life as a kind of reality TV show was very much part of Berlusconi's formula. And he did effectively dominate the press for a good 20 years.
What was his Make America Great Again?
Well, in fact, it was funny. He very much studied Ronald Reagan and also Ross Perot. He had a kind of, unlike Trump, he had a less angry political approach. He had more of the kind of Morning in America Reagan quality about him, a kind of more sunny optimism of our best days are ahead of us. I've become fabulously rich. I'll make all of you fabulously rich. Just let me try. Both of these figures occur after the end of the Cold War in a kind of post-ideological age. Berlusconi had no really strong ideology other than a kind of general free market approach, which he then freely ignored when he saw fit to. And what he was selling was himself in the same way that Trump said, I am the only one that can fix this. He's selling himself. And Berlusconi had very much that kind of approach. It wasn't really a detailed program. There was no detailed program in the same way that there's not with Trump. But one thing that is an interesting difference is that Berlusconi had to build a party along with a candidate, which was an exceptional achievement, not to be diminished. He elected to Parliament two of his own criminal lawyers who would literally spend half of the week up in Milan defending him in court, then fly back to Rome and write the laws that would get him off the hook in the very criminal cases in which he was a defendant. So these were things that were incredible. And yet, the Italians were very reluctant to grasp the importance of the conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. When you talk to sort of ordinary Berlusconi voters, a lot of them would say, well, he's too rich to be corrupted. So the politicians, you know, they need to make their money through politics. He doesn't, so we don't have to worry about that.
Right.
And that very clearly wasn't the case because his fortune increased massively during his time in office. And as soon as he was out of office, the stock of his company would begin to fall.
Give Donald Trump credit for working his butt off in that campaign. He was out there for a year and a half without flagging and not seeming to tire. Did Berlusconi work it that way? Were his rallies anything like as energizing or maybe as much work as Trump's were?
Yes, he was a remarkable live performer. I attended a couple of those rallies, and he had a really electrifying, charismatic effect on his audience. He had early on in his working career done a little work as a crooner on a cruise ship, and he had this kind of way about him of being on stage that reminded you of somebody like Tony Bennett or Frank Sinatra. He would walk around with the mic and establish a kind of rapport with the audience, and then he could extemporaneously just sort of launch into a monologue, much as Trump does. It was very, very powerful, very persuasive. He worked very, very hard.
We got to touch on some of these uncanny personal connections. The slogans, the color, Berlusconi loved blue. So does Trump in a way, but he likes red in there too. But the very edgy sexual suggestion and scandal around both men, their palaces. Berlusconi had a Baroque building in the center of Rome. I read in your book that it had belonged to the family of a pope back in the 17th mm-hmm. century. He also has his country villas, Trump, his tower, and his Mar-a-Lago. Again, the impunity. Trump boasted that he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. Berlusconi, too, completely immune to personal charge. What is this character?
They are billionaires who have a kind of everyman touch. It's a weird combination. They use rough and often vulgar language. They're not afraid to insult people. And weirdly enough, this ends up actually authenticating them with their own public. Part of their formula of success is that by speaking, let's say, like a truck driver or a bar owner, that they're just a regular guy. You know, when he was visiting the earthquake zone with a woman engineer, he said, "Can I caress this woman?" This is on, you know, with the TV cameras rolling. He thought he was being funny. Most people were appalled, but it didn't hurt him. I think it's also not coincidental that Italy and the U.S. are two countries where our media was deregulated, broadcast media was deregulated almost entirely.
Yeah, all of this would be utterly fascinating if it was just two guys' stories. But in fact, these men come to wield incredible political power. I got to say, I mean, I watched the Trump campaign very carefully, but nothing scares me about Trump so much as your story, 10 years old now, of what Silvio Berlusconi could do.
Well, I think there are a few things. Number one, I think there is a kind of crisis in general of the kind of social contract that existed in Europe and the United States in the 30 or 40 years after the end of World War II started to function less well. You get increasingly low levels of growth starting in the 90s and a disappearance of manufacturing jobs. And this creates unease and dissatisfaction in the population. There's a sense that the system isn't working for people in the way that it used to. You also had the phenomenon of immigration beginning to happen, and this then caused a kind of conflation in people's mind. Things must be going badly because there are these people that I don't recognize that are now living in my town. I remember talking to an acquaintance of mine who had been a kind of guy on the left in the 70s and 80s and who became a Berlusconi supporter in the 90s, saying to me, "Look, you know, you may not like these people around Berlusconi. They're kind of crude and they're likely to pinch the rear end of their secretaries, but they're the ones that are going to change Italy. They're going to shake things up." And I said, "Well, I'll be very, very surprised that happens." And in fact, it didn't happen, but they did pinch a lot of rear ends. And so it's a kind of fatigue with and disillusionment with traditional democratic norms that creates an opening for characters of this kind.
Alexander Stiller spoke to us from Columbia University in New York, where he teaches journalism. And then there's the non-journalist who stands out today as Silvio Berlusconi's worthiest and most telling adversary. She is the actress, filmmaker, and comedienne Sabina Guzzanti. From a political theatrical family in Rome, she's a mix maybe of our Michael Moore and, say, Sarah Silverman. She got famous with her late-night TV impersonations of Berlusconi, and more famous when he got her thrown off the state network. And then she became a force in films. On the phone this week, I asked Sabina Guzzanti for one of her Berlusconi impressions in our language over a Skype line.
In English, it's tough. It's like he speaks like this. Berlusconi English is even worse than mine. Good sounds like this.
Sabina, people say you were the most powerful response that Berlusconi ever met, and he finally had to take you off television to contain you. Explain this. What were your weapons? How did you think of it? What did you do?
I just refused to be scared, nothing more than this. Everyone was very scared because he fired everyone who didn't think like him. So I've been fired too, but I kept fighting. And because politicians started to be all like him, trying to make jokes, being very corrupted, with no sense of shame. Anyway, Italy as a country, it's done. We don't have a solution because we don't have a respectable politicians anymore. Nobody trusts politicians anymore. We cannot see a future, basically.
This is fascinating. What do you mean he changed the culture? 20 years of Berlusconi changed taste and even values, morals.
Yes. Well, Italian people watch a lot of television. It changed basically television. Then we don't have such an industry in movies, so it was already weak and became even weaker. But television became so bad. The level was so low and was so vulgar, everything. And people started to look like the television we watch it.
Your gift over decades fighting Berlusconi was satire, mockery, and then a kind of edgy coverage of hard facts, like the earthquake at L'Aquila, and broke that cover up. Explain that. I mean, tell us what happened.
Well, someone one day came to my house saying that in this city something weird was going on, and I went to the city to verify what I heard. And the thing was that this was a city which was a symbol of Berlusconi success because it was apparently dealing with this tragedy of the earthquake very well. And thousands of journalists were there and nobody saw the reality of what was going on. Was not a success at all. They were showing to the country that the city was doing very well. They were rebuilding the city and wasn't true at all. The city is still like the first day after the earthquake, and a lot of money has been stolen as usual. So it was a big propaganda event. It was completely fake. I was there when the TV news were like making a frame to show to the people that the city was fine, and all around the frame was destroyed, and they took like a small piece of wall which was up. And the funny thing that even the people was there was in a way believing in what television was saying because they wanted to believe everything was going well.
Come back to the satires, the jokes, the parody, the send-up. Just making fun of this man, it seemed to work better for you than it did for straight journalism just to lay out the numbers or something.
People believe in satirists, my kind of satirists, more than journalists. We don't trust journalists anymore because actually they're not honest at all and they are not clear. They always try to manipulate the public opinion So satirists were more direct. I make parodies of a lot of politicians, not just Berlusconi, and I just give informations in a different way, in a way that people can get the sense of what is going on quicker and with a better sense of participation. When you hear news from journalists, you have the feeling you are not involved. When you hear it from satire, you have the feeling politics belongs to you.
Can show business save us, maybe?
Show business, no. Artists, no. Forget it.
Satirists?
I don't think satirists can save the world at all. I think sense of humor, maybe, but not in satirists, in everyone, because sense of humor is, in a way, is a way to show you're not scared.
That was the actress Sabina Guzzanti in Rome. She'd like to say that under Silvio Berlusconi, Italy ranked 53rd among the nations for its protection of free speech. She's still free, and she's still talking.
Amore, amore mio, mon amour.
Here's just a taste of Silvio Berlusconi, the cruise ship crooner.
E te volevo scrivere una lettera, però aggiù pensate, meglio una canzone, perché no, teneva voglia pazzi di vedere.
Can you match that, Mr. Trump? Coming up, a caution about Trumpism from the former editor of The Economist from London, which had a famous headline about Berlusconi in the 90s. It said, "The man who screwed an entire country." This is open source. The Economist is the weekly newspaper from London that covers not just finance, but politics, culture, and science around the globe, with a wistful air now and then that Britain should be running the whole game. 15 years ago, The Economist took an untypically personal aim at a foreign chieftain, unfit to lead Italy, the paper judged. 5 years ago, The Economist headline was, "The Berlusconi era will haunt Italy for years to come." I asked the then editor of The Economist, Bill Emmett, to remind us how that fight began.
We were looking for bad businessmen to write about, if you like, the unacceptable faces of capitalism. And we'd done a series of them, one about Rupert Murdoch, one about problems that Richard Branson's Virgin Atlantic had got, one about the Formula One motor racing business. And someone suggested we should look at Silvio Berlusconi. And to be honest, I, as editor, wasn't very familiar with who Silvio Berlusconi was at that time. But once I started to look into him and get a sense of what he was about, I realized that actually he was much more than an unacceptable face of capitalism, a bad businessman figure. He was a case of someone who entered politics in order essentially to become his own regulator, his own regulator both in terms of governing the judicial process against him, but also regulating his businesses in media and in real estate and in advertising. And he was crossing the line, it seemed to me, between the market and government, between democracy and capitalism. And so he struck us as someone who was of global interest rather than simply a quaint, exotic Italian story. So we put him on our cover initially in 2001. Just before the Italian elections, he was trying to become prime minister, and we put a cover title on there which said, "Why Silvio Berlusconi is Unfit to Lead Italy." Of course, the electors disagreed. He was elected, and he served as prime minister for the next 5 years. This started a long engagement between us and Silvio Berlusconi, in which he sued us twice. He really anointed us in a way as his foreign public enemy's number one, which was very flattering of him. And one of his newspapers, Il Giornale, picked up on an accusation he made that The Economist was a well-known communist publication.
Oh, my Lord.
It picked up on that by putting my photograph as editor on their front page and pointing out that I look like Lenin, which is indeed true.
How would you describe The Economist, this Walter Badgett's weekly view of the world, cosmopolitan, sort of liberal, not untainted by a certain residual British imperial view? Describe it.
I think The Economist is classic liberal of a European form. In other words, we believe in freedom. We believe in open markets. We also believe in internationalism while being highly socially progressive. So we are the sort of publication that could pioneer advocacy for legalization of gay marriage, for example, while at the same time suggesting that monetary policy should be the benchmark for economic management and that budget deficits are not necessarily a good idea, as well as backing privatization. So we're liberal in that European sense.
Back to this intense focus on Berlusconi. So much of it centered on conflict of interest, an almost unknown category in Italian politics 20 years ago. What did you find?
Well, it was very clear that Silvio Berlusconi, by virtue of his ownership of the three major commercial television channels, as well as a number of news publications, had a conflict of interest whenever his government were going to get involved and the parliament was getting involved in the regulation of the media, of the communications industry. And he insisted that he should retain ownership of this media empire. And the opposition to him initially thought that they should pass legislation to prevent this, but then decided to back down on the basis that, well, we shouldn't demonize Silvio. He'll understand that there's a conflict of interest here and he won't run things in his own interest. This proved to be flat wrong. He did bring in legislation which benefited his own companies, and he proved a lesson which I think Americans now need to learn, which is you've got to stick to the principles. You've got to stick to the core constitutional values that you have and you've cherished. Do not expect the best of any president, and certainly not a president who comes in with so many conflicts of interest, potentially, as Donald Trump.
Was there a final score between The Economist and Berlusconi?
We would say that we won because we defeated him in both the two libel actions that he brought against us. However, he could say that he won in the sense that he had two subsequent times as prime minister. He was prime minister for 8 years, and he remains now at the age of 80. One of Italy's still most powerful politicians. He's trying to get back into parliament even. He has shown himself to be an enduring presence on the Italian scene. What he has in common with Donald Trump is the mixture of money and communication skill. Donald Trump has as his communication assets a smartphone in his hand that he uses for Twitter. Just as Silvio Berlusconi would always try to speak directly to the Italian people and get round troublesome journalists like you and me, Donald Trump will, as he's shown, always try to communicate directly with the American people through Twitter and through television.
Bring the lessons home to the United States as you see them about opposition, about journalism, about some underlying fungus on democracy as we've known it.
The lessons for the United States now and for American media and media in America, which, of course, my old magazine, The Economist, is included, is that it must be absolutely vigilant. The price of liberty is eternal vigilance, goes a famous phrase in American politics. And that is the lesson of Berlusconi, that the task of accountability has to be relentless, even in a so-called post-truth age and with a president who, like Silvio Berlusconi, plays extremely fast and loose with the facts. The relentless pointing out of facts and of errors and of lies and of misleading behavior and maybe even, if it happens, errant behavior is the absolutely vital task. Shrugging shoulders and saying, oh, well, this will blow over. The Republic is strong enough. Just wait another few years and we'll have a new election is damaging. And that is what happened in Italy. The media basically decided to shrug its shoulders and to some extent do business with Silvio Berlusconi, partly because he was a powerful man in advertising sales himself through his agency, but also just he was the power at the time. And we cannot afford the checks and balances of our democratic systems to do that. We have to be relentless, not in an unfair way, but in an absolutely vigilant way.
It's a little hard to imagine for me the establishment press going to war against the president continuously. At the same time, I wish they had you know, when George W. Bush was inventing the war in Iraq. How is this going to work? Can you imagine the New York Times, which was so close to Kissinger, has always been close to the highest offices in the land, keeping a determined spotlight on suspicion without discrediting the great institution?
I believe it can and it should. My philosophy of journalism is that we should never be so close to concentrations of power. You know, The Economist has never been in that kind of position.
Extraordinary. Yeah. Independently owned and minded.
Independently owned and minded. And I think one of the great advantages of The Economist is that it is international. So I appreciate that for The New York Times, being close to American centers of power is a big temptation. The Economist is, in a way, detached from all centers of power. And that's one of its privileges as well as its advantages. Now, it's not a matter of being at war with the new administration. It's a matter of being totally detached and cool-headed, disinterested in how it behaves and what it does. And I think that that's possible. And indeed, I think it's vital for the future of our media. After all, we are absolutely not just at war with a particular political group, but rather with Facebook and Google and all the new media that is going around us. I think that if we do not do our fundamental job of being reliable, of holding to account, of being like the best and most constant vigilantes for truth and justice, then we basically write ourselves out of a job.
Well, of course, that's a clear and present danger for all the established media. Berlusconi owned the visual media. Donald Trump is way ahead of most of us on the digital media, Twitter especially. Is this a fair fight coming up?
Well, I think that Donald Trump is very skilled in using digital media and using Twitter. I think he's basically also a super salesman. I mean, that is what he and Berlusconi have in common. They are both made their businesses, made their money as super salesmen, including for themselves. And I think that what Donald Trump has got on top of is the way in which he can use Twitter especially, but also television, for his own promotion and to communicate directly with the people. So it's a fair fight in the sense that this makes him exposed on a daily basis. It's an unfair fight in the sense that by being almost like a machine gun communicator, he can move the news agenda on very, very quickly. That's what Berlusconi used to do. He would say things that completely contradicted each other within hours, and certainly within days, but the news cycle moved on quickly, and they got overlooked and forgotten or just disregarded.
Bill Emmett, speak to the dread that a lot of people feel about democracy itself, that it's weak. It was terribly weak in Italy. It's weakened. It's compromised. It's substantially owned by the interests in our country. It's easy to see in Italy a kind of disease enfeebling the popular will, popular resistance. What about our own institutions? And what about democracy itself?
I think that democracy is always vulnerable to enfeeblement, to disease, to complacency, but also manipulation. And it requires for survival, and has always required for survival, periodic jolts and periodic wake-up calls out of its complacency in order to kind of throw away some of the manipulators and some of those who are taking over. And I think that this is no exception. Why is this happening now? I don't think that democracy is somehow fundamentally headed for the scrap heap. I think that why now? The answer to that is particularly the financial crisis of 2008, to which our established political parties, our established institutions have not found an answer and have left people angry and unhappy with their prospects, with their futures, with their potential living standards of future generations. The institutions of our democracies have gone through a period of significant failure. Now, that's happened before, and we've picked ourselves up again. We've had these periods of crisis before, and I think that we have a great ability to evolve, to find our way through these crises, as long as we're aware of what the problems are.
And they are?
I think our problems have been in the ability of concentrations of economic and political power, particularly in the latest case of the financial crisis of 2008, Wall Street and the banks, to capture the regulatory process, to distort public policy, both in the run-up to the crash, which led to the worst financial crisis since the 1930s, and then in the aftermath of it and in how things have been managed since then, in order to privilege themselves and not the rest of the country. And we need to return to a more equal and less monopolized political system.
How do we get there? And how do we define the problem of neoliberalism? Money essentially as the measure of all things, as opposed to social health or justice or fairness even, or even the general good. The case is out there, and a lot of Americans responded, including Donald Trump, to the notion that the game is rigged.
I think Donald Trump has been right to say that the game is rigged. It's been rigged by people who have accrued enormous amounts of political power through money politics, through campaign finance donations, through the power of their sector, like Wall Street has, the banking system, have totally dominated the regulatory process over themselves since the late 1990s. And what we have to do is to try to empower politics, political parties, political institutions, to fight back against those concentrations of power. Now, that's happened before. Under Teddy Roosevelt, in the after the previous Gilded Age in the United States of monopoly and the absolute concentration of power in the Carnegies and Vanderbilts and Rockefellers and so on of their age, Roosevelt began the progressive era through massive antitrust initiatives and breaking up Standard Oil and so forth. And I think that is what we need again. My view, and this is what I write in my forthcoming book, The Fate of the West, The Battle to Save the World's Most Successful Political Idea, by which I mean liberal democracy in the West and our alliances. In that book, I absolutely accept that Donald Trump, in his campaign, as indeed other political parties around the world in some cases, have been right about what some of the problems are. He is right that in some ways the system has been rigged. I don't think that he's likely to be right about the solutions on the basis of what he said during his campaign, but we must wait to see.
What do your solutions look like, Bill?
Well, my solutions look like ways to break up concentrations of political power, to improve the workings of the market system in such a way to discourage monopoly, and a restoration of a sense of equality, which does need to include the tax system, but it must also include more equal access to education. And we need to have openness. I'm absolutely against protectionism of all kinds. We need to have openness, but we need to combine it with the sense of equality that comes not from socialism, but from a sense of equal opportunity and equal citizenship.
Bill, it's hard to describe the dread in this country, not everywhere, but a sense of sunset time for the Republic.
I don't believe that it needs to be a sunset time for the Republic. I don't like to be too Reagan-esque in saying that the best is yet to come. It's morning in America. But I do think that there's a huge potential for reform and revival in the United States. I don't think that it's at all foolish to think that America cannot be made great again, as your president says. And I absolutely hope that forces can be mobilized to achieve that. I think that they need to be vigilant about threats to democracy and about the way in which corporate power, and particularly money power, could manipulate the democratic process, particularly with the power of communication that we're seeing today. But you have a system with the best checks and balances in the world. And I think in the past you've been one of the best systems for renewing and reinventing yourselves, even politically. So I'm going to watch it with great interest.
That was Bill Emmett, out of The Economist Now, running a provocative reformist website at the Wake Up Foundation, putting statistics, media, and all sorts of creative campaigning into the fight, as it says, on dangerous trends in Western societies. Thank you, Silvia Poggioli, Alexander Stiller, and Sabina Guzzanti. Thanks also to Daniele Albertazzi and Hurley Zinkowski in Rome. If you're going to be in Boston on February 4th, comedian Jimmy Tingle's show, Jimmy Tingle's Humor for Humanity, will be at Sanders Theater. Use the code OPENSOURCE when you buy your ticket, and you'll be helping open source at the same time. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our strong man. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.